Lufthansa flight LH615. A Boeing 727, a medium-haul jet that was widely used at this time. Three jet engines, one on each wing and one at the rear of the tail. On October 29, 1972, the jet with flight number LH615 took off at around 5 a.m. on a short flight from Damascus to Beirut. No passengers on board. They only board in Beirut. The regular crew takes over in Beirut too. According to the flight plan, the plane is scheduled to take off from Beirut at 5:45 a.m. and initially fly to Ankara in Turkey. From there on to Munich and finally to Frankfurt. It turns out differently. Flight LH615 represents the final chapter in the attack by Palestinian terrorists on the Israeli Olympic team. We have meticulously reconstructed what happened that day, and we are also investigating a scandalous suspicion voiced by Anki Spitzer, the widow of the murdered Andrei Spitzer.
It was all planned and all organized beforehand. Germany wanted to get rid of these Palestinian terrorists.
German authorities involved in fabricating a hijacking to free imprisoned terrorists, which are actually never prosecuted to this day. Even if the last proof is missing, there is some evidence that exactly this could be true.
Geheimakte 1972. Das Olympia-Attentat in München.
Hallo Tunis, wir haben die israelische Mannschaft in unserer Gewalt.
My brother came to do sport in the Olympics and they were murdered there.
Die ganze Geschichte, investigativ recherchiert. Bisher unveröffentlichtes Material.
I was contacted by a German journalist, Christoph Lemmer.
Geheimakte 1972. Die ganze Geschichte.
Hochweg September mehr allein.
Episode 11. Freigepresst.
Welcome to the last episode of our Secret Files 1972 podcast. 1.5 months have passed since the Palestinian terrorists attacked the Israeli Olympic team in Munich. All 11 Israeli athletes murdered. 5 of the 8 terrorists die in a chaotic shootout with German police officers. 3 terrorists survive and are in custody in the 3 Bavarian prisons in Munich, Stadelheim, Kaisheim and Straubing, where they spend their last night on the morning of October 29th. We have meticulously compiled what happened that day from the files, including the logbook of the Lufthansa Operations Center, internal reports and protocols from the police, telexes between Lufthansa, the federal government of Germany, and the Yugoslav government, logged radio messages from several aircraft, and statements from crew members and passengers.
On October the 29th, 1972, at around 5:10 a.m., I took over the Lufthansa plane LH615 at Beirut Airport. It had come from Damascus without passengers.
This is Flight Captain Walter Clausen. He was leading the crew that day. With him in the cockpit, a co-pilot and a flight engineer. 3 stewardesses and a purser. There are also 13 passengers on board. 11 in economy, 2 Arab men in first class. The stewardess, Constanze Marx, said,
"When the doors were already closed, one of the 2 first class passengers caught my eye because he wasn't dressed very well and had such a funny look. I thought to myself that maybe he was invited to the flight by the other first class passenger."
As usual in first class, there will be welcome drinks this morning. The 2 Arabs are sitting in the front row. One of the 2 refuses the drink. The plane taxis to the runway. LH615 takes off from Beirut with a delay of around 15 minutes. The plane is just airborne when the stewardess, Maya Meinke, notices something.
One of these Arabs stood up. It was the same one who refused the starting drink. He went to the toilet very purposefully. I have flying experience for 2 years now, and I can roughly judge the behavior of the passengers. I believe that this passenger who entered the lavatory knew exactly what type of aircraft it was. Still jokingly, I said to my colleague that this could be some guy trying to hijack a plane.
The stewardess also remembers that the two Arabs did not bring any hand luggage. Nevertheless, they had a bag to hand on the plane, says stewardess Constanze Marx.
Yeah, we wondered how it was possible to bring explosives and weapons on board. The hijacker in first class had the letter bag in front of him, which he had obviously brought on board. He took the explosives out of this bag. Normally, the explosives should have been discovered during an inspection of the bag.
All the bag was already on board, possibly placed in the toilet in Damascus, the Syrian capital. Syria has been a supporter to the terrorists from the start. Some of the perpetrators had been trained in Syria. They had traveled from Syria to Munich via Libya. At that time, Syria was ruled by the dictator Hafiz al-Assad, the father of today's Syrian ruler Bashar. Since there were no passengers or service crew on the short flight to Beirut, an elaborate hiding place would not have been necessary. There was no one on the plane who could have entered the toilet. Co-pilot Gerd Meyer says in his testimony.
From what we have found so far and what we have been able to find out, the weapons must have been in the plane on the flight from Damascus to Beirut. The controls in Beirut were as normal as ever, and it shouldn't have happened that people got things in like that. They must have been on the plane before.
By chance, what a coincidence, a private investigator also happens to be among the passengers in second class. His name, Hans Niemann. When questioned later, he says he was in Beirut on business, whatever that means. Private investigator Niemann about the first minutes of flight LH615.
A warm meal was served shortly after the scheduled start. Soon after, the food tray was cleared away. I still remember the captain's announcement that we were flying over the southern tip of Cyprus. A short time later, I became aware of the passengers and stewardesses coming from the front part of the machine, from the kitchen at a fast pace, holding their hands over their heads with a disturbed facial expression into the rear cabin.
At the front of first class is the purser, the cabin manager named Jacques Abrahams, a Dutch citizen.
It was triggered by the two first-class passengers who had boarded last. Both suddenly had a gun in their hands.
One of the two hijackers rushes backwards toward economy class.
The moment I got a clear view of the connecting door to the kitchen, I saw a man there aiming a revolver at us, hip-locked. He shouted in English, "The Palestinian command has taken over the machine!" He drove the people standing in the aisle to the back of the cabin with threatening gestures, telling them to sit down in the back and put their hands on their heads. He himself stayed under the connecting door and held us in check with his gun. A short time later, there was a longer speech in Arabic over the loudspeaker system, which I did not understand. Then the same male voice issued a statement in English, beginning with the words, "The Palestinian command has taken over the plane. The new captain is speaking."
Flight Captain Clausen describes the beginning of the kidnapping from his point of view as follows.
About 10 miles north of Cyprus, someone armed with a handgun entered the cockpit. Prompted by a change in noise in the cockpit, I turned to see a man pointing a gun at me. At first, the perpetrator said nothing. He immediately chased the flight engineer back to the cabin and told us that he would take care of what was to come. I believe he literally said in English, "I'm the new captain." He also said this to the passengers and over the radio to Nicosia Airport. He then gave a new flight number labeled Munich Operation.
A new call sign. From then on, all air traffic control centers and authorities actually followed the terrorists' captain's first announcement. They no longer address the machine as LH615 over the radio, but as Munich Operation.
The firearm was a brownish pistol, probably a Belgian model. I would first like to enumerate what weapons the perpetrators carried with them and in some cases also demonstrated to me. In addition to the second suspect's pistol and revolver, they had explosive devices wrapped in cigarettes. All you had to do was to take some tobacco at the front and snap off the filter at the back, revealing a long, small explosive device. They had hand grenades hidden in the isolator. As far as I know, these are ceramic insulators, such as those used for high voltage lines. The hand grenades were probably Czech models. The hand grenades were cylindrical, brownish in color and ringed. As far as I know, explosive devices probably with the flashlight batteries were attached to the doors. The main perpetrator, who called himself Commander, spoke English. However, his English wasn't very good.
The kidnappers say what they want over the radio. Land in Cyprus immediately and fill the tanks with kerosene to the hilt. Then onward, flying to collect the three surviving terrorists of the Olympic massacre in Munich, and finally fly on to an as yet undisclosed destination. The first condition is met immediately. LH-615, now renamed Operation Munich, lands in Nicosia, refuels, and immediately takes off again. Destination Munich. It took a while for this hijacking to get around amongst German officials. The head of Lufthansa flight operations in Munich, Riem, where the Munich airport is located at that time, logs every event throughout the day. For 8:30 a.m. local time in Munich, he notes the top entry.
Hijacking noticed.
Lufthansa made contact with the machine via shortwave radio at the headquarters in Frankfurt.
8:50. Call from Frankfurt, Mr. Stolz. He spoke to the captain and the hijackers via HF. Plane is on the way to Munich. Estimated time of landing 10:50. The three terrorists must be ready upon arrival.
The police apparently only found out about the kidnapping from the public broadcast news. This may be due to the fact that it is Sunday and some offices are not manned. The authorities also log what happens. The first entry in the police report is from 9:08 a.m. Apparently, the broadcast report was on the 9 o'clock newscast.
According to a radio announcement, in the early hours of the morning, an LH plane was captured by Arab terrorists after taking off from Beirut. This measure is intended to free the three Arabs held captive in Germany who survived the attack on the Israeli Olympic team.
The police investigators call Lufthansa in Munich Riem and leave a request for a callback. A little later, the head of Lufthansa flight operations, the man who coordinates at Lufthansa and also keeps the Lufthansa log, calls back. He confirms the report on the radio is correct. A plane was actually kidnapped. It should fly to Munich. The Lufthansa flight operations noted the hijackers' demand one more time.
The three terrorists must be ready upon arrival.
Which might be difficult. One of the terrorists is still in Kaisheim, 128 kilometers from Munich Airport. The other in Straubing, 140 kilometers away.
10:08. LH-311 has contact with LH-615. LH-311 reports that the kidnappers are serious.
LH-311, this is another Lufthansa plane that is close enough to Munich for radio contact and has direct radio contact with the Lufthansa operations in Munich. At the same time, LH-311 radioed with a hijacked LH-615 and forwarded its radio messages to Munich. A common practice that planes radio each other and pass on messages very quickly in this way.
10:12. LH-311 transmits again. Kidnappers are in attendance of pistols, hand grenades and explosive devices. If the three terrorists are not at the airport when they arrive in Munich, the plane will be blown up. Captain Clausen is alone in the cockpit with one of the kidnappers. LH-615 broadcasts on frequency 13172.
And immediately after that, another plane radioed Lufthansa Munich, an Israeli El Al machine. It is also within radio range of the hijacked LH-615. The Israeli aircraft has the registration number LY219.
LY219 El Al is transmitting on frequency 1315. LH615 is at flight level 200 and will stop at Zagreb for refueling.
Flight level 200 means 20,000 feet or 6,000 meters altitude. And the other Lufthansa machine, LH311, adds...
Estimated time of landing in Zagreb, 10:35.
In the meantime, the terrorists have secured everything up there in the hijacked plane. Private detective Niemann in his testimony.
The man was standing further under the connecting door, the revolver pointed at the passengers at waist level, and in the other hand holding a white object resembling a spray can. I suspect that this was an explosive device. Then he suddenly fiddled with his waistband and pulled out a longer rope. He stared at the stewardesses and passengers. He pointed at me and motioned for me to come over to him, which I did. He asked me in English where the knives are in the kitchen room. I explained in English that I didn't know this because I was passenger, not a steward. He sent me back and asked the stewardess to come over, who then gave him a knife. When I stood in front of him, I could see that the aforementioned cord was a fuse. It was sand-colored and had a rough texture. He cut the fuse with the knife and set detonators on it. This he gritted with his teeth. He then introduced them into the aforementioned explosive devices. In between, the guard asked an Arab passenger to collect the passports and hand them over to him, which he did.
The terrorists inspected the plane from end to end. They also inquired about the tailgate, a peculiarity of the Boeing 727. At the very back, a flap can be slid down, which is equipped with a staircase and allows passengers to enter and exit the aircraft without the need of an airport gangway.
The stewardesses and the steward explained that this door could only be opened from the cockpit and that the staircase was behind it.
At some point, the terrorist is done and goes to the cockpit where his accomplice is sitting with Captain Clausen. Immediately afterwards, an announcement on the plane.
The same male voice as initially made an announcement in English and Arabic that the rear door and galley door were charged with explosives. The passengers were warned not to operate the doors or remove the explosive charge. Both would result in the machine being blown up.
Passengers must change seats and move to the front of the cabin in front of the galley. Then the situation on board relaxes a bit. From time to time, the boss of the two kidnappers drops in on the passengers, sits down and explains the situation. He speaks Arabic to the Arab passengers and English to Niemann. The government has agreed and will fulfill their request. The three jailed members of the Palestine Commando at the Olympics would be released. The Munich police have put together a crisis team. A task force made up of police leaders and public prosecutors meets with helpers at Dream Airport.
10:30 a.m. All journal officers at the police headquarters, a total of 40 clerks, are on standby. Separate radio traffic is handled on channel 470.
Emergency doctors and Arabic interpreters are summoned. And then something strange happens. Also at 10:30 a.m., Criminal Inspector Schleindelsperger, one of the leading police investigators, recorded the following.
Criminal Inspector Spandl was instructed to have the deportation orders of the three terrorists in custody, which were kept at the office and prepared by the immigration office, brought to Riem with the clothing provided by an officer.
Even if the wording of this entry is not completely conclusive, one thing emerges from it. There are already prepared expulsion orders against the three terrorists. So, is the suspicion of Anki Spitzer and others are expressing correct? Was this hijacking planned beforehand? Germany making common cause with terrorists? Was the kidnapping of LH615 fake? Was the purpose to get rid of the three imprisoned terrorists? I found this particular expulsion order against the terrorist Badran by chance in the Munich State Archives. It's on a file locked until 2042. It is an official form on light green paper issued by the City of Munich Office for Public Order Immigration Office. The order is permanent. It is expressly noted.
Ban on re-entering the federal territory.
The authority justifies the expulsion as follows.
The presence of the person concerned poses a serious threat to the internal and external security of the Federal Republic. There is a significant security risk for people who, like Badran, commit crimes against humanity on the territory of the Federal Republic of Germany and who threaten life and limb of the population with terrorist attacks. Expulsion pursuant to Section 10, Subsection 1, Numbers 1 and 11, Ausländergesetz, and deportation pursuant to Section 13, Ausländergesetz, had to be ordered because, in view of impending dangers, they represent the only reliable means of successfully counteracting further attacks. The danger of going into hiding must be countered under all circumstances in the interest of the security of the population and the international fight against terrorist groups. For the same reason, the application of Section 13, Subsection 2, Sentence 4, Ausländergesetz and the order for immediate enforcement as a measure required in the urgent public interest are justified.
Mind you, solely in the German public interest, because the deportation means at the same time that the terrorists could go into hiding abroad or possibly even spread new terror with the knowledge and will of other governments. And it was precisely this decree that was already complete on October 29th, as Detective Inspector Schleindelsperger recorded. It was also immediately available despite Sunday and the closed authorities. And it was one of the first acts of the police that day at 10:30 a.m. to send a courier to have the expulsion orders against the three terrorists at hand. Of course, that's not the only oddity of the day. Anki Spitzer knows even more detail.
Weeks before the hijacking, which, like I said, was on the 29th of October, the German ambassador in Tripolis, he got a telegram, and I have that telegram, saying that he should prepare himself because in some time, in a few weeks or days, he will receive three of the surviving Palestinian terrorists in Libya. So he should know this and he should prepare for it.
And Anki Spitzer names another source, General Fritz Wegner, who founded the legendary elite unit GSG-9, with which Germany wanted to better arm itself against terrorism after the total failure in the Olympic massacre. She met Wegner, says Anki Spitzer, and he knew the background to the October 29th hijacking.
They made a deal with them, because this I heard from General Wegner, the head of the GS9, and I asked him because he knew about it, and he said yes, it was a fabrication, and they knew that this was going to happen, and they made a deal that the Palestinian organizations would not do another terrorist attack on Germany. So they made a deal; they let the terrorist free, and they got for this the promise that the Palestinians would not attack again on German soil.
But that's probably not all. We remember Abu Daoud, the chief planner of the Olympic massacre against the Israeli athletes. Abu Daoud, later in his autobiography, also described the deal about the hijacking of flight LH615.
The fact is that in the autobiography of Abu Daoud, the mastermind of Munich, and also with the admission of George Habas, it says there that he got $9 million. Abu Daoud, the mastermind, said, I didn't want to do it because I'm not doing hijacking. So that's why he gave it to his friend George Habas, who did it. And, you know, it was a totally fake hijacking.
Which the federal government and German authorities always firmly deny. When Anki Spitzer negotiated with State Secretary Brigitte Tsipras from the Ministry of the Interior in 1999, she confronted her with this passage from Abu Daoud's book and with the accusation that Germany had paid $9 million to hijack a plane and supposedly let the three terrorists go free.
How did Brigitte Tsipras react when you confronted her with the 9 million to George Habash?
She never reacted to the fact that I said, you know, it's more profitable to be a terrorist because they got $9 million.
Did she deny what you said when you said that Germany paid $9 million to George Habash?
No, she didn't deny it, but she didn't react to it, you know, and she took it as a very not nice saying of me that it is more profitable to be a terrorist.
Of course, I also asked Brigitte Tsipras how she remembers it. She responded by mail with just this one sentence.
I do not remember any such reproach.
And ends her sentence with three dots, whatever they are supposed to mean. Back to October 29th, 1972, 10:30 a.m. The police task force requests the already prepared expulsion orders for the three imprisoned terrorists. At this time, they are still in the prisons in Kaisheim, Straubing and Stadelheim. The hijacked LH-615 is still on its way to Munich and is currently flying over Yugoslavia. Captain Clausen in his testimony.
Shortly before Zagreb, the perpetrator demanded to fly to Zagreb airport. There, he demanded full tanks again. The reason was later given to me. He just wanted to pick up his three friends in Munich and start again without refueling.
10:32. LH-311 reports LH-615 is approaching Zagreb. Flight level 45, runway 07 plant. 10:38. LH-311 reports LH-615 is leaving an altitude of 2,000 feet. Landing permission Zagreb has been granted.
Then the announcement was made by the same man to buckle up and stop smoking. A short time later, there was a landing. I'm not able to say whether the statement that this is Zagreb is based on my own perception or information. The machine went to the furthest point on the runway and was refueled there. The refueling process was completed relatively quickly, and after a short time, there was a new start.
10:40. LY219 El Al reports LH615 requesting 10,700 kilos of fuel. Tank truck approaches the plane.
In Cologne, the CEO of Lufthansa, Herbert Kuhlmann, takes off in a small private jet of the then Lufthansa subsidiary Condor to Munich. His security chief and a reserve cockpit crew for the hijacked LX615 fly with him. Kuhlmann plans to replace Captain Clausen's crew in Munich.
Message from Munich Air Traffic Control. LH615, takeoff time in Zagreb 11:19. Estimated landing time in Munich 12:00.
Shortly after takeoff from Zagreb, LH615 has direct radio contact with Lufthansa Control in Munich for the first time. One of the two hijackers speaks into the microphone in the cockpit.
11:35. Over radio 13175, direct contact with the kidnappers for the first time. They demand the immediate extradition of the three terrorists. From now on, you will change the call sign LH615 to Operation Munich. The hijackers also point out that no exchange of passengers is planned in Munich. After the three terrorists have been handed over, the passengers will fly to an Arab country.
The kidnappers have very specific ideas about what the procedure in Munich should look like.
In the further course of the conversation, the kidnappers demand that the three terrorists have to stand by themselves when they land at the runway, so that they can go on board immediately after landing. The kidnappers' question where their three comrades would be is answered with the confirmation that they are in the prisons of Munich, Kaisheim and Straubing. Captain Clausen was given permission to speak. He points out that the two exit doors are closed by the kidnappers, have been provided with explosive devices.
Until then, the Munich Police Task Force only takes note of what is happening in the air and what information Lufthansa is passing on. Police Chief Freiber only arrives shortly before 12 noon. He confers with his staff and appoints a chief negotiator who is to negotiate with the terrorists over the radio. He leaves open whether the hostages on board will be exchanged for the terrorists or whether the terrorists should simply board as the kidnappers demand. Meanwhile, the hijacked LH-615 ARCA Operation Munich is circling in the airspace overhead Munich Airport. The hijackers are getting impatient. They expect Germany to finally fly their comrades and helicopters to Munich Riem to be picked up.
When we learned from Munich that the helicopters would probably not be able to land, he wanted to switch to Salzburg.
10:55. The kidnappers decide to fly to Salzburg. At the same time, they ask whether the helicopters with the terrorists can land in Salzburg.
In the Lufthansa logbook, the hijacked LH-615 is now only referred to as Flug Munich Operation, i.e. with the call sign the hijackers gave this machine.
10:59. Munich Operation is informed that the German government must first contact the Austrian government to determine whether the helicopters can land in Salzburg and whether the Austrian government will give its approval for the hostage exchange in Salzburg.
There is a discussion in the cockpit of the hijacked plane. Landing in Salzburg, Austria, instead of Munich?
I was able to talk to him out of this due to various complications and suggested landing in Nuremberg. However, he then decided to fly back to Zagreb.
Since we couldn't see the ground from the plane, I didn't know where we were at all. In my opinion, we flew for almost 6 hours and must have been over the Federal Republic. It was all very uncertain. A passenger who acted as a translator told us when he came out of the cockpit that we were about over Hamburg. Then I had a conversation about a machine that wasn't allowed to start. I didn't know what that meant.
Then the kidnappers on board spread the word that Germany will probably meet their demands.
During the flight, we must have been directly above or near Munich. We were told that one of the Munich attackers were already at Munich airport, and the other two attackers were also coming to the airport. The Arabs in the machine hugged and kissed.
12:17 p.m. Message from air traffic control. Machine back to Zagreb, where they are waiting until the three prisoners can be taken.
12:19. According to Munich air traffic control, the machine turns to Zagreb.
Government agencies seem increasingly overwhelmed. In the minutes of the task force, there is an entry that a senior public prosecutor requested police vehicles with special symbols by telephone so that some public prosecutors could be chauffeured to Riem Airport with flashing lights and tattoos. Otherwise, the task force only takes note of the information provided by Lufthansa. At the same time, a crisis team is meeting in Bonn with interior and transport ministers. Telexes go back and forth. The federal government is ready for an exchange. Hostages for terrorists, but not for simply letting the terrorists board.
12:30 p.m. Arrival of prisoner Badran from prison Stadelheim. He is taken to the Lufthansa lunchroom. 12:36 p.m. Helicopter departs from prison Kaisheim with prisoner Altnavi. 12:40 p.m. Helicopter takes off from Landsberg Lech with prisoner Abdullah Samer.
An official must have made a mistake here because Samer was not imprisoned in Landsberg, but in Straubing. Altnavi and Samer are flown to a police barracks in Munich while Badran is already in the airport building. Unlike Badran, Altnavi and Samer are flown to a police barracks in Munich and temporarily detained there. They arrive later at the airport.
1317. Trying to get Munich operation on 3175. Unsuccessful. 1319. No contact. 1322. No contact. 1324. SGL call, selective call, Charlie Golf, Fox Kilo, unsuccessful. 1326, no contact. 1328, no contact. 1334, no contact. 1338, no contact. 1340, no contact. 1344, no contact. 1348, no contact. 1351, no contact. 1352, CF-419 calls and reports that it can hear Zagreb on frequency 1246.
CF-419 is another jet again, this time a Condor airplane, which is in radio range from Zagreb and Munich and mediates.
1356. CF-419 heard on 1246 that hijackers said the plane had fuel for a very long time and that they intended to wait overhead Zagreb until the three terrorists were ready to be picked up in Munich.
Aboard LH-615 ARCA Munich operation, the hijackers keep their hostages informed. Another loudspeaker announcement.
He stated that, contrary to previous promises, the two remaining comrades were still not at the German airfield. A longer period of circling above the clouds then passed.
2:50 p.m. Arrival of Al-Navi and Abdullah Samea. Two helicopters brought them from the police barracks at Rosenheimer Straße to Munich Riem Airport. They will be picked up by an air traffic control vehicle and a police car and taken to the Condor jet parked in the immediate vicinity. The prisoners are handcuffed and sit in the back of the plane. 3:10 p.m. Badran is also brought to the jet. 3:12 p.m. The undersigned boarded the plane with an interpreter and handed the three prisoners on remand the expulsion orders prepared by the immigration office against confirmation of receipt. The content of the expulsion orders will be translated accordingly.
Everything must be in order, with written acknowledgement of receipt. The small Condor jet, that's the plane with which the Lufthansa CEO flew to Munich. The plan now looks like this. The three terrorists are to be brought to Zagreb with the Condor jet. There they should change to the hijacked Lufthansa jet. This should bring them to have freedom. The message is broadcast on the usual established channels to LH-615 ARCA Munich operation, which is still circling overhead Zagreb. Then, according to private investigator Niemann, the head of the kidnappers came into the cabin.
And in an obviously relieved and also happy way made the announcement that the German government had shown understanding and that the three comrades would now be taken on board in Zagreb. The news also caused great relief among the passengers, especially the Arab passengers, which almost bordered on slight euphoria among them.
Which raises the question of who these 11 passengers taken hostage actually were. I come back to that at the very end. In Germany, the atmosphere was meanwhile a little more tense than on board the plane, especially at the crisis management team in Bonn and at the Munich Police Task Force. Here are dialogues that went back and forth by telex between the German embassy in Yugoslavia, the police, and the Bonn crisis management team.
For your information, we just spoke to the kidnappers. Do the free people here in Zagreb want to get on? They didn't want to say what happened next.
What is the Yugoslav authorities' position on this transaction?
The Croatian security minister is on the line and is currently having a telephone conversation with the Belgrade crisis team. But in my personal opinion, nothing stands in the way of people changing trains here in Zagreb. Are the people in Munich and is there a plane ready to go to Zagreb?
The three are here in Munich. An airplane is ready to take off. It is very important to us that the passengers be released in exchange for the terrorists.
We had already asked the kidnappers, but we don't want to make any concessions without getting the people's possession. But I will get back to you.
Okay, thanks.
I now need a telex urgently for telex to Belgrade for landing permission because the crisis team in Belgrade cannot be reached at least at the competent point by telephone. Then get back to you immediately. Bye-bye.
Can you please find out if Louis Trenka is on board?
Louis Trenka at that time was a famous Alpine legend and TV star in Germany. He had nothing to do with this hijacking. It's unclear why this question came up.
Please do not block telex. And here is the written confirmation that the Yugoslav government allows the special aircraft to land in Zagreb and that the exchange may take place here.
Who is responsible for giving this permission? Name and title, please. And one question, why is it possibly said?
Since the kidnappers seem to have other plans now, permission came from Belgrade from the German ambassador who mediated there. Name is not known to us. What does the special machine do?
What is the special machine doing? This question must have been extremely urgent for the questioner because he typed 3 question marks after it.
The special machine is here with the comrades on board, ready to take off.
Why doesn't it take off?
Because the Ministry of Justice wants the official written declaration of consent from the Yugoslav government.
Okay, we are trying that.
And here is how the Lufthansa flight operation logs the drama of what is going on.
1516 to LH634. The plane with the 3 Arabs is ready for takeoff in Munich and is waiting for the Minister of Justice approval to take off for Zagreb. 1524. From LH634. Time is up. Operation Munich will land in Zagreb. 1526. From LH634. Operation Munich reports. We say goodbye. The federal government is responsible for everything else. 1528. To LH634. The federal government insists that the exchange has been approved, that all passengers in Zagreb will be released. The permit obtained from Yugoslavia gives permission for landing but not for exchange. 1535. From LH634. Notification that the threat is serious. Chief of Police Schreiber, Lord Mayor Kronawitter and Mr. Kalman are listening and talking to Bonn. 1536. Captain Clausen sent word via LH634 that the minister should give takeoff permission immediately. He leaves no doubt that the kidnappers will carry out their threat.
The mood darkens again on board. The boss of the hijackers talks to the passengers again.
It was clear from his statement that the 3 comrades had not yet left Munich, contrary to what had been agreed. With an unmistakably threatening undertone in his voice, he repeated again that it had always been his endeavor not to harm either the passengers or the crew. However, he could no longer guarantee the further course of events. He will not allow any tricks. Should anyone try to attack the machine or him, he would not hesitate to blow up the machine with all occupants, including the crew. The German government alone would be responsible for this. He emphasized that up to now he had shown a great deal of patience, but that his patience would come to an end if the German government breached its word. It should be noted that we passengers and stewardesses knew nothing about the nature and content of the traffic between the cockpit and the outside world.
1540 to LH634. The aircraft with the 3 Arabs will take off from Munich, but is not allowed to leave German airspace before the exchange hostages against terrorists has been secured.
The pressure from the kidnappers begins to take hold. Other men board the small Condor jet in which the terrorists are waiting to take off. A chief criminal officer and a chief inspector from the Munich police. Lufthansa CEO Kullmann. The head of Lufthansa security. A flight captain who should replace Captain Clausen in Zagreb if possible.
1547 to LH634. The Condor plane takes off in Munich. One of the 3 Arabs will contact Operation Munich as soon as possible. the federal government still insists on the exchange in Zagreb,
which the kidnappers stubbornly refused to accept. And yet the Condor plane took off with terrorists on board. Of course, the terrorists forbid to leave German airspace before the federal government has agreed to the condition.
16:00. Condor is called by us. No contact.
Around the same time overhead Zagreb and the hijacked Lufthansa plane. Captain Clausen makes an announcement over the onboard loudspeakers, which Private Detective Niemann reproduces as follows.
He explained in German, "We are now acting on our own initiative. We've bypassed our noble government somewhat. Daddy will do it." He added that everything would go well.
When the tower in Munich calls the Condor machine, it no longer answers. Police President Schreiber calls on air traffic control to once again forbid the pilot from leaving German airspace. It doesn't answer. At 4:22 p.m., air traffic control already locates the aircraft over Yugoslav airspace. The plane has already passed Austria. Chief of Police Schreiber must have trembled with anger. His commanders recorded that Lufthansa CEO Coleman had to carry all responsibility on his own. It was probably Captain Clausen, the hijacked LH-615, who put the pressure on. He spoke frankly during his interrogation.
In my opinion, the captain of the Condor plane and the entire crew of the Condor jet knew perfectly well that our time was running out, that in the most critical phase we were practically approaching the bitter end. I explained to the Condor captain exactly how to behave. At the end of the critical phase, I directly demanded that the Condor jet take off in the direction of Zagreb. I ordered this directly. The Arabs had constantly threatened to blow up the machine if they ran out of fuel. I was finally informed that the Condor was rolling and had finally started. I waited for the moment when I could speak to its crew myself, to personally ask the captain again to get the maximum possible speed out of his machine.
16:40. Telex from the federal government of the Yugoslav government. In this letter, they asked to declare their willingness to participate in the exchange of hostages and terrorists if this can be done without endangering third parties. If an exchange is not possible, the three terrorists must be brought back to Germany with a special aircraft.
I had contact with the Condor for the first time when it was above Klagenfurt. I made it clear to the captain once again with all urgency that he must make his approach to Zagreb at top speed since we are out of fuel and that he cannot lose another minute. In the meantime, the Arabs spoke among themselves and I also spoke to the other captain.
The situation on board became more and more precarious. Co-pilot Meyer testified.
One of the kidnappers had the hand grenade in his hand all the time, his fingers on the trigger. So there was no chance anymore.
I instructed the captain of the Condor jet that he should roll out with his machine to the end of the runway in Zagreb and let the three men get off there, and then he should immediately leave the runway himself with his machine and the other occupants and get to the apron.
16:56. Message from air traffic control. Condor landed in Zagreb at 16:40. Operation Munich approaching Zagreb.
We landed right behind the Condor plane, so I had to do an overshoot to make sure everything was as we said it would be. After the overshoot, I landed immediately, and the three Palestinians who were standing at the end of the runway climbed over to us.
17:30. Message from air traffic control. Operation Munich landed in Zagreb at 17:08.
After landing, my colleague Abrahams opened the outer door of the plane. Three men came on board who were the three Munich assassins. And when entering the machine, the men were frisked by our kidnappers. I cannot judge whether the Munich attackers and our kidnappers knew each other.
After defusing the explosive charge on the rear door, the three men entered the machine via the rear stairs. The rear exit was immediately secured again by the guard with an explosive charge. The three people from Munich stayed for some time and he stayed in the main cabin, where a joyful greeting was given to the Arab passengers who were sitting there. Abdullah was the first of the three Munich comrades to make his way through the galley into the cockpit. He laughed seemed relieved and happy and answered yes when I asked if he felt better than before. He was absolutely open-minded and willingly responded to all questions from the passengers, especially about his prison stay in Germany. After that, Badran came into the galley. He ostentatiously brandished the signal pistol belonging to the plane equipment. He had the cartridge case for the signal pistol hanging around his neck. He also went forward into the cockpit. We got to see the third Munich relatively briefly. He walked quickly down the galley, face a little more serious and withdrawn, and disappeared into the cockpit.
And then the whole process stalls again. The authorities in Zagreb refuse to refuel the machine. Radio messages and telexes go back and forth again, co-pilot Meyer.
We still had full for a maximum flight time of 10 minutes. After landing, we stood on the ground and switched off two engines. Then we had another 3/4 of an hour full for the electrical equipment. We let the third engine idle. After the demands had been met that the tanker would come, one of the engines had already begun to shake, so it would have been a maximum of 2 minutes, then it would have been over. The threat was that the plane would blow up the moment the electricity went down.
Yugoslavia only allows refueling at the last moment. LH-615 Aka Munich operation immediately taxis to the runway and takes off. At first, the kidnappers did not want to reveal where they were heading for.
When the boss was asked where to go next and what the further course of events would be like, he explained that it wouldn't be long at all. However, he deliberately avoided any indication of the location and limited himself to the statement that the flight destination was in an Arab country. He then went on to admit that it is one of the largest airfields in the Arab world. He could guarantee a risk-free landing there and the integrity of the crew and passengers. We would have the opportunity to stay in one of the best hotels completely free of charge. He now urged the stewardesses to serve food and drinks.
And then, finally, the explosive devices were removed from the doors.
When I realized that the explosive charges were still attached to the doors after about 20 minutes of flight time, I asked the boss to defuse them and that the stewardesses were terribly afraid. When nothing happened, I asked him again to defuse the explosive and told him again that the passengers were very afraid because of the explosive charge and pointed out that the German government had ultimately kept their promise. I went on to say that with the turbulence that was just beginning, an accident could not be ruled out. Shortly thereafter, the guard also began to defuse and dismantle the explosive charge. He carried the individual components into the second-class cabin.
2010. Condor is still in Zagreb. In any case, the machine will return to Munich. 2047. Condor reports on frequency 13175 via Klagenfurt. 2121. Condor landed.
Shortly before the later landing, it leaked out that we would land in Tripoli, Libya. Shortly after landing, a Libyan police officer or soldier entered the plane with several civilians. From the way they greeted the civilians, they seemed to know the kidnappers personally, but also the three people from Munich. After a joyful greeting, they then had lengthy conversations with the boss. When I asked him whether these gentlemen were government officials or his friends, he replied that they were his friends, saying that they were not government officials. It seemed clear to me that this gentleman was a receptionist for his underground organization.
2125. Communication from air traffic control. Operation Munich landed in Tripoli at 2125.
When the three terrorists left the aircraft, Libyan uniformed officers inspect the plane next. When they are finished, employees of the German embassy enter the machine. They take passengers and crew with them. They spend the night in a hotel in Tripoli. The next day, Captain Clausen flies the plane back to Germany. And here the story ends. None of the killers of the Israeli athletes was ever charged or brought to justice. Two of them are still alive. One of them is living in Damascus. the other in the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon. The one in the Bekaa Valley is Al-Dinawi. His real name is Mohammed El-Safadi. He said in a television documentary, he still sees the killing of the Israeli athletes as a heroic act, not a crime.
Geheimakte 1972. 50 Jahre nach dem Olympia-Attentat in München. Ein Podcast der Antenne Bayern Group.
This podcast, Secret Files 1972, is a joint team effort. Thanks to all at Antenne Bayern who took part. Markus Kessler as Station Voice. Cordula Senft as Anki Spitzer. Lenny Petiano as Al-Dinawi. Sebastian Riechel as Document Voice. Arno Siegemund as Ministry Voice. Jutta Ribrock as Brigitte Zypris. Hakan Turan as Lawyer Alexander Knob. Stefan Lehmann as Criminal Investigator and Interrogator. Sigrid Leininger as Hertha N. Jamil Deininger as Abu Daoud and Private Investigator Niemann. Christian Schwietzke as Taxi Driver Zachi and Lufthansa Operations Voice. Josie Schreiter as Mika Slavin. Chris Dütertri as Samer. Philipp Allard as Badran. Lisa Marie Köster as Gertrud Lauterbach. Kevin Jackson as Soldier Leindecker. Simon Lappenbach as Sokolski. Garrett Kohr as Fencer John Alon and Captain Clausen. Markus Pöppel as Postman Heinz-Peter Gottelt. Fidelius Franek as Postman Thomas Arno. Hendrik Dorm as Policeman Heiduk. Lisa Reister as Anneliese Gräß. Maxim Auer as Mahut. Ralf Zinno as Dr. Riese. Mark Geisler as Policeman Heinz M. and Telex Dialogue Voice 1. Florentine Kari as Telex Dialogue Voice 2. Yves Simon as Criminal Officer Schmidt. Seban Schmidtbauer, Felix Ruderer and Stephen Mack as Snipers. Fabian Filker as Khalid. Jörg Mutsam as Interpreter. Markus Lukas as Purser. Lisa Augenthaler as Stewardess Constanze Marx. Nadine Werner as Stewardess Maya Meinke. Roland Braun as Co-Pilot Meyer. Translation Supervision Audrey Seebach and Chris Dutertri. Production Martin Geisler and Luisa Süßmuth. Graphical Design Alexander Königseder. Editorial Staff Philipp Allard. Online Editors Nora Moritz and Marie Resch. Lectorate and Producer Jörg Mutsam. And I'm Christoph Lemmer and I say thanks to all of these guys and this fantastic team. כוכבי ספטמבר מעלי, 11, כולם זהב.